Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that, were it an art museum, would feature eat-as-you-go popcorn paintings and statues made entirely out of milk duds. I'm totally serious. Anyway, art instead of movie treats is on this week's agenda as we offer up a special episode dedicated to three movies that touch on the world of great art. But unlike so many hagiographic studies, these films look past the usual public relations pamphlets. One, titled Simply Sin, is a feature film about the real life of one particular genius, the master Michelangelo di Lodovico Buonarroti Simoni. The other two, both documentaries, delve into the contemporary world of dicey art sales. Their titles, My Rembrandt and Made You Look, A True Story About Fake Art. Let's begin by heading back to early 16th century Italy. Unless we're talking about the one-eared Dutch painter with the unpronounceable last name, at least unpronounceable by non-Dutch speakers, movie producers tend to portray great artists in a mostly PG-rated fashion. Okay, occasionally PG-13. Sin, a film directed and co-written by the Russian filmmaker Andrei Konchalovsky, fits more in the hard R category, detailing that period in the life of the Italian master Michelangelo during and just after his painting of the Vatican Sistine Chapel. Sin delves into how the people of that time really lived, with trashy streets and poor personal hygiene, just as prevalent as the political power plays that both sponsored and, at times, suppressed the creation of great art. Michelangelo himself, played ably by Alberto Testoni, though clearly a supremely gifted man, here is also portrayed as a duplicitous schemer, a greedy double-crosser, and prey to the kinds of mental disturbances that we tend to associate with tortured genius. Konchalovsky even has him talking aloud to the spirit of the great Italian writer Dante. The result is a strange and irreverent, though definitely affecting, look at the man behind some of the greatest art ever conceived.
Well, I want to compare this movie, Sin, to what still is the most famous depiction of Michelangelo in narrative feature film, which is Carol Reed's film, The Agony and the Ecstasy from 1965, which almost improbably stars Charlton Heston as Michelangelo, which is such a bizarre casting choice because he's like, you know, you associate Charlton Heston with almost like a stilted stoicism. Like he's a piece of marble himself that has yet to be, you know, chiseled into something. And it's an interesting casting decision, but I guess he was just synonymous with historical epics at the time. But you look at that movie and then compare it to this one, to Sin, which has almost all agony and very little ecstasy. I mean, you did mention sort of the religious ecstasy that comes through where he's seeing these, are they hallucinations? Are they actual divine visions? Because this does kind of exist, even though it has, as you mentioned, the sort of gritty realism of what would it really be like to live in this era in terms of, as you said, the hygiene and how everybody looked and behaved. It does kind of exist in a weird sort of fantasy realm at the same time, which I think is in keeping with the style of Michelangelo's art at the time. And Michelangelo himself, I mean, comparing it to Heston, this guy Alberto Testone is so much more tortured and so much more erratic. And we see him getting drunk and then confronting people in the town square and then throwing up all over them, which I can't imagine Charlton Heston ever doing. And he also just has a great face. He has you know, the pointy Michelangelo beard, and then he has these deep fissures of wrinkles all throughout his face. It's so expressive and great. Like, I just loved looking at this guy's face.
And those eyes.
Yeah, I'd never seen him before, but he's fantastic in this, I think. As for the movie, I admired it, and I liked what Konchalovsky is doing. He's such an unusual filmmaker in general. I mean, I think most people would probably know his more, you know, mainstream stuff like Runaway Train, but he has since been working in his native Russia, and here this is a Russian-Italian co-production that's now available in virtual cinemas, we should say, is how we saw it. But this was a bit slow going for me. I mean, it's about 2 hours and 10, 15 minutes, and it felt a little bit longer to me. And obviously the period of time that this movie is dealing with is when he's about to start work on the Sistine Chapel ceiling, or he's been commissioned almost against his will, because Michelangelo wasn't a painter. He was a sculptor, and yet he was commissioned to do, you know, one of the most famous public pieces of painted art in history. And so it's less about that and more about kind of the socio-political circumstances that led to him being commissioned in the first place. It's about the changes that Italy and the Catholic Church and the papacy were all going through at the time. And so in that regard, this is almost like the Mank of Renaissance art, because it's less about the famous piece of art at the center than it is about all of the things that led to the art. So there are some beautiful images in this. I mean, that image that's on the poster of Michelangelo being dwarfed by this giant monolith of marble is such a potent one, and I think sums up everything. Because, I mean, we can also talk about how this is essentially about how difficult it is to be an artist and how it's always been difficult to be an artist. That's what this movie is about. I think that sums it up perfectly. But here we have, you know, 135-minute movie that kind of rambles a little bit when you have that central image that kind of sums it all up in only a couple of seconds.
And I do think that maybe more so than some other films, this does portray the difficulty of being a sculptor. I mean, I can't even imagine, because we go with Michelangelo to the quarries in Carrara to find, you know, the exact piece of marble. And he decides, as Nathan pointed out, that he wants this large intact slab. And so all the logistics associated with dealing with that, you know, come into play. Of course, there's the ongoing feud between the Medici family and the Del Rovere family and the popes that are associated with each of them. And it sort of goes back and forth between Rome, Firenze, and Carrara. And you can't see that much of a distinction between Rome and Florence necessarily, because it all looks pretty, I guess, gloomy.
And grody.
Right, at this point. But it does get into his relationship with his benefactors. It gets into his relationship with his family members.
His assistants.
Right. And we go back and forth between thinking that this guy is a tortured genius and thinking, oh, he's just... he appreciates his own self-worth and he's trying to work that angle, or, you know, we just have sort of different perspectives on who he is and how he is in the world.
Yeah. And we have to point out that most of us, when we think of Michelangelo, you know, we do think of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, but we also think of the David. I mean, and if you've ever seen that piece of sculpture in person, it will blow your absolute mind. It is one of the most amazing things that I personally have ever seen. This is beyond that. It's barely mentioned. We only see it out in front of the palazzo there in Florence. Although as the movie ends, there is a short little sequence which goes to show you some of the aspects of Michelangelo's better sculpt works.
Gets in real close with details of, you know, the veins in David's hand and all right. of that.
If ever there was a movie, though, that you would apply itself best to smell-o-vision, this is it. Because people are walking down alleyways and they're dodging
chamber pots being
emptied right out there on the street. And
okay, you know, John Waters.
Yeah, really. Another interesting thing is you mentioned Konchalovsky, Nathan. Runaway Train was a bizarre movie in and of its own self. So, yeah. I mean, to equate that as his more mainstream effort, that's a bit of a stretch.
It was an Academy Award nominated movie. So
I'm not going to argue that.
Okay.
It was still a strange movie with John Voight's strangest performances ever.
For sure. Well, and I want to say in regards to Sin, because I mean, and with that title, I mean, obviously that's something that runs through pretty much all art of the Renaissance era, because it was so Catholic in nature. And of course, Catholicism is obsessed with sin. And we see that in his daily life. He's surrounded by avarice and greed and adultery and everything else. And then, you know, his work is like the divine version of all of that. I was most interested, I think, in just the details of how the art was made. I mean, you, Mary Pat, you talked about going to those marble quarries and watching how they break the pieces out from like the sides of these mountains and they go tumbling down, and hopefully they don't break apart. And, you know, the talk
about- Hopefully they don't kill somebody.
Well, and yeah, and you're just waiting for that to happen. And of course it does. And there's all this talk about the economics of how money changes hands so that he can afford to do his next project, how he has to keep taking on commissions in order to fund his next project.
Yeah, it's like a Ponzi scheme almost.
It's like the gig economy, but in, you know, 16th century Italy. So it's interesting to see how I believe that Kontrolovsky researched this movie for years to be sure that it was historically accurate. And it feels that way. Again, I do think that it is a little slow and a little meandering, but I think the moments of greatness in this are really great. I think it's going to be a tough sit for a lot of people that aren't art history students.
Let's make sure that people know that it is in Italian with English subtitles, which if you like to hear the beautiful Italian language, that's another plus for this, to recommend this movie.
Yeah. At any rate, that was the feature film Sin. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcast to Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at the documentaries My Rembrandt and Made You Look, A True Story About Fake Art. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. We're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the feature film Sin. Let's now move to the documentaries My Rembrandt and Made You Look, A True Story About Fake Art. Let's begin with a study of several art lovers who covet, for various reasons, the works of the 17th century Dutch master Rembrandt, Harmen Zoon van Rijn. Known, like Michelangelo, by a singular name, Rembrandt is also a revered name in art. The documentary My Rembrandt, directed by the Dutch filmmaker Uke Hoogendijk, doesn't so much delve into the life of Rembrandt or his career, other than to pass off a few quick remarks about how temperamental the man could be. But instead, it focuses on those who seek to own or profit from the purchase of his paintings. This includes everyone from a Scottish duke to the governments both of France and the Netherlands. Central to Hoogendijk's film, though, is Jan Six, the scion of a notable Amsterdam family who seeks to make his way through the discovery of a previously unknown Rembrandt portrait, and who, in the end, may be just another in a long line of art hucksters aiming for personal gain.
This film, as you indicated, it's captured in the title. It's My Rembrandt. It's not Rembrandt. And so this really is a tale of ownership and of, you know, love. And in some instances, it's just sort of one-upping other people who have the wealth to own something such as this. Because at one point, one of the individuals in the film is just so taken with the fact that I could own a Rembrandt. I could own a Rembrandt. I could put it in my living room.
I can touch it whenever I want.
And it was sort of like, I don't know about that. And then we see other people who appreciate more fully, hey, I have this really unique work of art. And I had and found myself in a position financially to purchase it, but I'm going to put it on loan to a museum so that everybody can appreciate fully this particular painting. And so we have all these different sort of perspectives and viewpoints on what it means to own priceless work, I guess. But the real intriguing part of this film does come in, as you point out, Dan, when we're looking at Jan Six, because he has been trying to make his own way in the world. And he's clearly like a fourth generation trust fund baby or whatever. And he is trying to do something unique. And he does get pretty deeply involved with the art scene and Rembrandt in particular. But he is convinced that he has found a previously unknown Rembrandt. And so it takes us all through in this movie, My Rembrandt. It takes us through all of the different efforts to sort of verify that painting. And of course, I think people appreciate if you stick around for the last film, you'll see how these two films are connected in a major way. And you should see My Rembrandt before you see Made You Look, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, and you're right, Mary Pat, that the important part of the title, My Rembrandt, is the my part. Because I mean, the essential question of this movie is, I mean, it's asking a few questions. It's asking, who gets to claim ownership of a priceless work of art? How do you assign value to a priceless work of art? I mean, it is priceless after all. And then who gets to decide which artists are priceless in the first place? And if you find a new Rembrandt, as this guy claims he does, how do you prove that it's real and that it has value? And so it explores all of the ethics of just the idea of a painting by Rembrandt existing in the private sector, the idea that somebody with enough money to blow could buy one and hang it in their living room, which we see these giant Rembrandt canvases, that this pair of them hanging in this wealthy guy's living room. And you just think, like, how is that okay?
How did that even happen? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is, we see the fighting between the two countries, and the French government doesn't come off so well in this one, because they had originally agreed to purchase these paintings. So it's a set, a man and a woman, and they had agreed for a joint purchase. And then all of a sudden, France doesn't have the dough. Or it does, except they don't want to put it out there until the last minute, because they feel as though, since these paintings are located in France, that they have sort of first right ownership to this.
And also, they have the Louvre. So, I mean, come on.
Right.
That must be where all the best art goes.
Right, right. And so then we have, the Netherlands pushing back and saying, hey, you know, this is our guy. This is our guy. You know, we want to bring the paintings home and so forth. And then interspersed throughout is Jan Six's struggle to show that he's a player in this whole scene.
Yeah, I mean, the whole saga of that guy is a roller coaster unto itself. And when the movie wraps up and we find out a bunch of stuff about him that we didn't know going in, it's like the rug getting pulled out from under you. It's a nice, fun, tricky reveal at the end of this movie.
And that's a nice segue into our second film, which is called Made You Look, A True Story About Fake Art. Picking up where My Rembrandt leaves off, this very average documentary explores the uproar that occurred in 2011 when the esteemed New York art gallery M. Nodler & Company was forced to close. The reason? The gallery for years had been selling fake copies of such artists as Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, Robert Motherwell, and others. Average benefits from the cooperation of Ann Friedman, the gallery's former director and the person who, depending on whom you believe, was either duped into thinking she was selling genuine works or was part of a particularly lucrative art world con game. Embarrassed, too, were the experts, some of whom Average interviews, who confirmed the works is real. In the end, one thing is clear: where there's big money, there will be people clever enough to find a way to steal their share.
This makes a perfect pairing with My Rembrandt that we just talked about. It would also make a perfect pairing with the Fire Festival documentaries.
Absolutely.
And that's because there is definitely some schadenfreude at play here. Obviously, nobody should be defrauded out of millions of dollars, but how bad do I really feel for someone who was able to just casually drop $1 million on what they thought was like a Jackson Pollock painting, and then it turns out to be fake? I mean, this scenario kind of bolsters the entire debate that My Rembrandt is centered on, which is, should great works of art be owned rather than displayed? And I was reminded of movies like Exit Through the Gift Shop or Who the Bleep is Jackson Pollock, which also dealt with authenticity within the art world. And it kind of asked a very complicated question, which is there not an artistry in making a duplicate painting that is so convincing. Yes.
Right.
Yes. So many people are convinced that it's real. And if nobody realizes it's fake and it's just on the wall and it has the immediate impact of, say, a real Jackson Pollock painting, is that not art itself? I mean, there's a whole debate you could have about that.
I
agree. And this movie could spark that debate.
Because one of the Rothkos that turns out to have been created in the back room in Queens is gorgeous. I mean, everybody is lusting after this painting, but are they lusting after
I don't get Rothko, so I didn't think it was gorgeous, but it was convincing.
Theater. Right, right. So are they lusting after this painting because of the way it looks or because of its value, because of its, you know, status, its functions as a status symbol, and only because Rothko painted it, not because in and of itself, it's a work of art that we admire and appreciate.
And because at least when they assumed it was real, it was previously undiscovered. So there is this sense of, I found this thing and it's mine now.
And I think that they got really good access to everybody, to so many different people who were involved in this. And that was a really important thing.
Yeah, I think the really fun part is looking at how these people were duped by some woman from Long Island and her Spanish compatriot, you know, I guess they were married at the time, how these people just like, oh, you know, I have this long lost painting, and all these people, so-called experts, I mean, all the way along the line, they were all duped into thinking, it's really bona fide, and that's a beautiful painting.
There was a similar documentary about the Mormon art fraud.
Yes, exactly.
That did a similar thing, where it's like, it's too good to be true, but you keep kind of, you convince yourself it's real. Also, I wish that the woman that had kind of been the middleman between this supposed art collector and the museum had been interviewed, because her situation sounded kind of harrowing itself. It sounds like this guy who is interviewed, that was kind of, it seems like he was really the mastermind of the whole thing. He just kind of threw everybody that was involved under the bus and ran away to Spain again. And so there are a lot of colorful characters in this movie, and it has the good sense to not be four whole hour-long episodes, which is what most Netflix documentaries are these days.
Yeah, right. Once again, though, see My Rembrandt first, then see Made You Look, A True Story About Fake Art, because they are really a good artistic tandem. All right, so this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the narrative movie Sin, the documentaries My Rembrandt and Made You Look, A True Story About Fake Art. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. We thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the great Pablo Picasso. Art is the lie that enables us to realize the truth. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.